later. I also want to apologize. I know that everyone here is very green, and I'm very conscious of that normally in my personal life. But I have also learned at conferences that when someone tells you to go to the website and get all this information, I rarely ever do it, and most of the people I know rarely ever do it. But I also know if I have pieces of paper that I continue to move because I don't want to throw them away because one day I'm going to use them, every time I move them, I remember, oh, I wanted to do that. I was going to do that. I'm supposed to do that. And so it's much more likely that you'll actually do something. So that's why you have some important papers on your desk, and you can grab some of these at the end that I think will be really helpful. And most of these we won't even discuss. So be sure and come look at them. The contact sheet on your desk is for sign up so that you can get our blog post, both our parenting, Christian parenting blog post, and our teaching tip blog post. The teaching is once a week, and the parenting one is three times a week, so you're not, your mailbox is not going to be full. I'm not a spammer, that sort of thing. And also, if you have questions or other ways you want us to help us, feel free to note those down and we'll take care of it. My name is Teresa Winnett. I'm the founder of Teach One, Reach One, and we're here to help you with your children and teen ministries. We want to do whatever we can. People often ask me if I monetize this. I don't. And the reason is because I'm passionate about children. And I don't want to have to make my living that way. God's blessed us. I don't have to. And so everything we do is either free, or if it requires me to travel, it's for expenses only. So as you're listening to all this and your mind's clicking dollar signs, don't. I'm sure if you work with children that you're aware that your ministry can have a tremendous impact on the lives of kids and teens. And we have a lot of great ideas and free tools and resources to share with you. But before we do that, I want you to walk with me to three typical children's classes. Now, who was in the wilderness baptizing? John the Baptist. That's right. And where was he baptizing them?
Jordan River.
Jordan River, you guys have got this lesson down. You know all the facts. That is so wonderful. Now, we're going to spend the rest of the class. We've got about 25 minutes left, and I'm going to give you this beautiful coloring sheet. I want you to really do your best work now, because we've got plenty of time to really color it well. You're going to want to take this home. Now, I don't want to see them on the parking lot like I do sometimes. Take them home. Put them on your refrigerator. All right, let's go in another class and see what's going on. Okay, guys, pop these balloons. Keep popping those balloons. Just like God wanted us to pop our sin. That's right. Pop them. Pop them. Pop those balloons. Yeah, keep popping them. Jesus wants us to pop our sins. John the Baptist is telling those people at the Jordan River to pop their sins. All right, let's go in our third class. Now, today we're going to be learning how to teach others about God, just like John the Baptist did. Let's see what else the Bible has to tell us about John. In those days, John the Baptist came and preached in the desert of Judea. Turn away from your sins. Turn away from your sins. The kingdom of heaven is near. John is the one the prophet Isaiah had spoken about. He said, "A messenger is calling out in the desert, prepare the way for the Lord, make straight paths for him." John's clothes were made of camel hair. He had a leather belt around his waist, and his food was locusts and honey. People went out to him from Jerusalem and all of Judea. They also came from the whole area around the Jordan River. When they admitted they had sinned, John baptized them in the Jordan. Now, how many of you have ever been to a desert? Well, this is a picture of the actual desert that John the Baptist lived and worked in. What's the weather like in the desert?
Hot.
It's hot during the day and cold at night. And John had to wear camel's hair. So imagine what that would have been like. And who remembers what he ate? Locusts and honey. Now, these actually, people, are real edible locusts. They are safe. I have used these in numerous other places, and no one has gotten sick or died or emailed me that they were traumatized. So if you have ever had the fantasy of eating like John the Baptist, this is your opportunity to do these. These are real, live, edible locusts. And you can dip them in honey if that makes it more palatable for you. But so after we have eaten the locusts, we're going to really know what it felt like to be John the Baptist. Then we're going to talk about what he preached and how we can share about Jesus just like he did. And we're going to make these great testimony t-shirts to remind us of the things that we need to tell others about how to be a Christian. So, like I said, make sure you taste a locust because it will help you remember this workshop. You will never forget it once you've eaten a locust. And I will just say, for those men who want to know and will come up to me for the rest of the week, you can purchase them on eBay from England. Do not buy the ones from South Asia. Buy the ones from England. So get that out of the way. Because everyone always asks me that the rest of the time. If I told you God had plans for a young person in your ministry, for kids and teens, for that child to impact the world for Christ in a major way, which one of those first three classes would you want your child in? What if you knew that child were getting little or no Bible at home? Now, an even tougher question, do you even know for sure what types of classes your church or ministry has? Do you know how well your volunteers are really reaching your young people for God? If you have not personally observed the classes in action, I can promise you what you think is happening is not necessarily what is going on in those classes. The truth is, our ministries to kids and teens are not accomplishing what they need to accomplish. Over the years, I've observed a lot of children's ministries around this country and really in other countries as well. Some are large, well-funded ministries, and others had no money at all. They're all over, and every single one was struggling with how to effectively minister to young people. By the time they reach adulthood, we should have helped our kids master the following things if we really want them to become productive Christians. First, they need an incredibly solid biblical foundation. They need to know not just the facts of what's in the Bible, which is what a lot of us have been doing for years, but actually how to apply it to their lives. They need a godly worldview. They need to know how to make choices through a God lens, how God would make them want them to make those choices. They need Christian life skills, and this is something I've learned just recently. I knew it, I guess, instinctively, but really have realized this is a huge gap for us. We teach them the application, but then they actually need practice. They need the practical knowledge of how to do these godly things. For example, if you're trying to teach the kids to be godly about money, how exactly am I doing that? How do I budget? How do I give money? How do I know how much to give? All those kinds of life skill things, they're not being taught for the most part. We need to help them discover and develop their gifts from God and know how to use them to serve Him. I've had some really sad conversations with older adults recently where they still believe that God gave them zero gifts. And I don't want any of our children to feel that way. So we need to help them discover those gifts and help them develop them and know how to use them to serve them. If they have a unique gift that's not a standard gift we use in service in our congregations, we need to help them figure out how they can use that gift to serve God because He gave it to them to serve Him. So even the most unique gift, we need to help them develop. Servant leadership skills, including serving others and faith sharing. Instead, our young people are leaving the church in droves. While church leaders have convinced themselves changing the name on the sign or the type of music or a variety of other doctrines and traditions will bring them back, the reality is much more fundamental. Young Christians with weak spiritual foundations will leave the church and even God when they don't get to do church their way. Young people with strong foundations may still lobby for those changes, but their idea of leaving the church family and God is not an option for them. To keep our young people and prepare them to win the world for Christ, we need to radically change how we're ministering to them. Before I show what our research and field testing have taught us, we need to change and how we can help you manage those changes, I need to warn you. And I've seen this happen over and over again, so I just want to prepare you because if you leave here excited and then go home and this happens, I don't want you to become discouraged. If you decide to enhance what you or your ministry or your church or whatever is doing with kids and teens, you're going to find that either yourself or people you're working with become infected with one of these three diseases that Satan loves to give us. The first one is King David's disease. You're going to hear denial. Problems? What problems? We have a great children's ministry. We love our children here. We put young people first. Now, inevitably, this comes out of the mouth of someone who has probably never actually seen his children's class, has no idea what, if anything, is being taught down that hall, and really, frankly, doesn't care that much. They don't know if their volunteers are strong or weak or if their programs are really strong or weak. They've just been in denial. Or they might have Naaman syndrome. You may run into this. Responsibility avoidance. Why do we have to change anything? This is a parent's responsibility, not the church. They should be happy with anything they get from us. And this is usually said by someone who doesn't want to be bothered with kids or bothered with changing or any of that sort of thing, or believes the church legitimately should have no role in helping raise people's children, that is totally their responsibility.
and that they're mainly there to entertain or keep the kids out of the adult way while they're in the building. Or you may run into Moses's complex, which is the mother of all avoidances. It's too hard to change. These are the excuse generators. You will hear it all. It's too complicated. We would have to train people. Our volunteers are undedicated, lazy, stubborn. Parents don't care. We'll get pushback. I've heard it all. You're going to hear it all. But if you find yourself or someone else infected, don't despair. This means that you're really doing something Satan doesn't want you to do, and you need to be praying and moving forward. You may have to take baby steps, and that's okay. People are fearful of doing that. They think it's an all-or-nothing situation, and you can take baby steps. We have found that even the tiniest of baby steps where I walk away from a ministry after watching them and going, nothing's going to come out of that. That is such a tiny baby step. And then I check back a couple months later, and it is amazing what God can do with baby steps. We have spent a lot of time researching and field testing and talking to people in the field, working with kids, of our theories and resources. We've learned there are five basic areas in ministry to kids and teens that seem to have the most impact, positive and negative, on your programs. But before we break them down, like I said, we are going to fly. Normally, these would be numerous seminars that we would break down, and we'd actually get to practice and play with it and process it and question it, and we just don't have that kind of time. So if you want those things, those are available for you. And you're going to feel overwhelmed. Just write your questions down in your contact sheet. If we get lucky and there's 2 seconds left, I'll take some questions. If not, I'll contact you after with the answer. Just remember, enhancing the effectiveness of your ministries is a process. You can't and shouldn't try to do it all at once, like we said. God is a multiplier, though, just like the loaves and fishes of the little boy. I think he multiplies whatever effort, when we give him our best, he'll take that and he'll multiply the effectiveness of it. And secondly, we're here to help you. I'm not going to dump all this in your lap and walk off and you never can contact me. I will sit on the phone with you. I will email you. I will come to you. I will do whatever I can do to help you. I am not going to abandon you. So take advantage of that and our resources of our team. So the first thing you need to do on your to-do list is assessment. Before you even think about making changes, you need to actually know for sure what's really happening in your ministries and programs. Even if you're providing literature, and I can tell you this from personal experience because I'm one of the people that did this, you've got people radically changing what you're giving them. And if you have not walked into that room and sat through a class, you have no idea what they're really doing with that literature, which is kind of scary if you think about it. We have developed a thorough assessment tool. I have a degree in education from William Mary. One of my co-students helped me develop this. It is thorough. So it is 2 pages long, but it is designed so if you have to give it to someone in your congregation that has no experience teaching children, has no background in that, and is the type of person where the kids were smiling, so it's a good class, it's really broken down step by step of very specific things that they need to look for that will make it more likely that they will come out with a valid assessment of what your strengths and weaknesses in your program are. We have those up here for you to take. Make sure you grab one before you leave. If your assessment comes out after you or someone else has done it, that your program is wonderful and perfect and there's no need for improvement, then you kind of got King David's disease, because there is no perfect program. And if you think yours is, then you're in denial and you can't enhance it, and your children are probably suffering in one or more areas because of that. Now, once you've done that assessment, then you're ready to start tackling what we call the Teach One, Reach One 5. And these are the 5 areas that have the most impact, positive or negative. Their goals, your volunteers, your curriculum, your classroom management, and your family involvement. When we begin working with most ministries and mission teams and mission fields, the first thing we ask is to hear their goals. Virtually no one has them. Okay, honestly, I have never met anyone who has had them yet. I'm sure someone does, and yay for you because you're the rare bird. But generally, I get this, especially for mission teams, they're so cute because it's a lot of college and high school people, and they're like, she wants an answer. I need an answer. Love them like Jesus. Like, good. Okay. The problem with that is that, what does that even look like? How do we know if we did it well? How do we know if we need to make changes? How do we know if we're even all on the same page of what we're trying to accomplish? Now, some of you are going to worry about, when I start talking about goals, of that Bigger Barnes thing where the guy got in trouble, but that is not what we're talking about. I'm not talking about those egotistical goals where we're going to baptize 97,000 people and aren't we a wonderful Christian. That's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about, like in Proverbs 16, when it says commit, what you're going to commit to the Lord. That's what we're talking, those kinds of goals, what we're committing to God that we're going to do with our kids and teens so that he can use that and it will keep you focused. Now, what we're talking about is not just your generic goal. Georgia is huge, where I'm from, is huge with Girl Scouting, and they have SMART goals, and a lot of you may have heard of that. We're talking about a modified SMART goal, and a SMART goal in our instance is specific and measurable. I want to see numbers, something that you cannot argue with a volunteer or a minister or an elder whether or not you accomplished it, because it's very measurable. Now, normally a SMART goal is achievable, realistic, and time-bound. But we're Christians, and we were just talking about this before some of you got in here. God's goals for us are much bigger than we can ever imagine. So I'm leaving all that achievable, realistic time stuff to God, because that's his. All I'm doing is worry about what I'm committing to him, that I'm going to try to do some specific, measurable things in it in for him. A non-SMART goal, to give you an example, would be our kids are going to grow up to be Christians. That's not going to help you a lot. In fact, you'd be surprised. You'll probably find there's some disagreement amongst people on your team what that even means. A SMART goal would be 3 students will ask to study baptism out of class this semester. Okay? So you're not trying to take control back from God, but what you are trying to do is keep yourself and your volunteers focused, because what happens, and you're not even realizing this, and I realized this years ago, is we miss opportunities God gives us because we get distracted. Oh, that kid forgot their code, or this da-da-da-da-da. You get distracted by this, and while all that's going on, some kid's going, Miss Susie, Mr. Bob, I want to know about baptism. And you go, okay, and you're not really even hearing it, and you're missing those opportunities. So having these goals there are going to help you're going to key in on that, and your volunteers are going to key in on that because it's written down. We had a great example. I was in another country doing this with a bunch of volunteers, and the missionary beforehand had said, oh, we have this big problem. We have all these kids coming, and we're not getting the parents in. The teachers are not doing anything. And so we just threw that out to do the SMART goal plan. We said, hey, let's talk about the parents, getting the parents here. They come up with great, really concrete, we're going to visit 5 family homes this month or whatever. Not only is that great because it's now they've committed to doing something specific, but now the missionary can hold them accountable. Did you go? Without any pushback. So that's why you want them. Don't burden yourself with more than 3 or 4, though. If you get more than that, you're going to be overwhelmed and nothing's going to get done. You can have like a long-term list off to the side somewhere that you gradually move things from that onto your short-term, but don't have more than 3 or 4. We have free consulting. I have this lovely little clipboard that you can come at the end and sign up. I will meet with you personally while you're here for free and talk to you and help you out with that, or by phone or email when you get back. We'll even come to you. We have a SMART goal worksheet if you're not familiar with that, and all that you want to help. Now, the next one is volunteers. This is huge. I cannot emphasize this. Or to your success or lack thereof, and it's the least likely that you guys are probably addressing because of fear. You either fear you're going to lose your volunteers, which you think are a scarce resource, or you're afraid you're going to have to hurt somebody's feelings. I want to reassure you, we have seen this over and over and over again. Your volunteers actually want a little more guidance from you, a few more boundaries, a little more structure. They are flailing in part because they're not really sure exactly what it is you want for them. So if you can help them in these areas with the things we're going to suggest, you may just find you have more volunteers and happier volunteers and volunteers that want to come along. If you had consistently been having trouble with acquiring volunteer recruitment and retention, come talk to me. We have a lot of things that we found worked over the years that most people just don't do, and so we can help walk you through some of that. In the meantime, if you're still concerned about requiring more from your volunteers, I want to talk about Cain for just a minute. I think, personally, Cain was one of the first people that tried to phone in his service to God. He just kind of threw it out there, is my impression of that sacrifice. And as we know, God was not happy with that. And as mean as it is, and I hate to say this, I think historically the church, and I don't mean just the Church of Christ, I mean Christianity in general, has phoned in our service to kids and teens. Good enough has been our best, and that's okay. And I just don't honestly believe that that's acceptable to God. And we have got to start calling ourselves and each other to a much, much higher standard, because these precious little ones we have the most impact on, and we're wasting it for the most part. If you're in a situation where you have mission teams that come serve you or something like that, and you're primarily only using volunteers to work with your kids to hook them emotionally into becoming donors, money donors, I want you to seriously reconsider that. Come talk to me. We can help you structure some kind of emotional experience that they will get the same bang for your buck and not put your kids in danger, so to speak, sometimes real, unfortunately, from tacky comments, poorly executed lessons, which can harm your program more than the money that they give you can help. If you actually need volunteers to work with your students, you need to start by giving your volunteers very specific guidelines for what you want them to accomplish rather than a list of tasks. I found this very frequently. Someone will throw a teacher manual at someone or say, just do a VBS. Whether you're on the mission field or in a church, you're going to get very uneven results. If you have a phenomenal person that's very talented, you may get something just out of this world phenomenal. The next time, you could get somebody that has no experience, and it's just a hot mess. So if you, instead of giving you a task, if you can give them very specific, as much as possible, guidelines, if, for example, you say, on Monday, we want you to do a VBS so that every student can tell us the godly principle taught in the parable of Good Samaritan, and then have them participate in an activity where they will practice being a good neighbor to others, you're much more likely to accomplish what you need and want to accomplish with that. So be really specific and be cognizant of the difference. The other issue we find with volunteers is that they often have very little preparation and training. Almost every ministry we have helped has asked us to come do empathy workshops. Ministry volunteers have plenty of sympathy, but unfortunately that hurts your children more than it helps them. What you really want them to have is empathy, and that will make your program have great strides. We do this workshop sometimes just minutes before a group of large children arrive, and over and over and over again, the programs that we have worked with us on have said the difference from previous times and after the workshop from how the volunteers interact with the children is like night and day, and the results are night and day. Basically, what we spend a lot of time working with them on is the intentionality of what comes out of your mouth. You would just be horrified what comes out of good, loving Christian people's mouths to little children that can put them on a trajectory where they will never walk in a church building again. Are you guys familiar with the book The Other Westmore? Okay, if you haven't read it, I really would suggest you read that book. It's a little raw because it is about urban life. Nothing too horrible, I don't think I remember in it. But the lesson is really important. It's about this man named Wes Moore. He grew up in inner city Baltimore, stereotypical, no dad, rough environment, drugs, exposure to crime, yada, yada, yada. But for whatever reason, he ended up going to college and got a Rhodes Scholarship. Well, when he was in England, I guess he got homesick or whatever, and he was reading his hometown paper, and ironically enough, another man from Baltimore, same name, Wes Moore, same age, same background, had just been sentenced to life in prison for participating in a murder. And so he was really intrigued, like, what was so different? Because on the face of it, we were exactly the same, and how did I end up a Rhodes Scholar, and he's in jail for life? And the research was really interesting as he delved into their past. It wasn't anything huge. It was actually literally one tiny sentence that someone said to each of them, or one tiny thing something did, and every sentence was moving him more in a positive direction and the other guy in the more negative. We recently heard a Holocaust survivor speak, and he said the same thing. He talked to, like, hundreds of Holocaust survivors over the years. Every single one of them credited their survival to one sentence someone had said to them. And we go through life thinking, maybe I shouldn't have said that, or not even thinking we shouldn't have said that, and not realizing how impactful that can be to these kids. I don't know how many of you are familiar with the dance world, but Misty Copeland is a positive example of that. She's the first African-American prima ballerina at the ABT in New York City, and she was in a school, eighth grade, which my daughter can tell you, you start at three if you want to be a prima ballerina. She was already 13, 14 years old, and some teacher said, "You've got some talent. We need to get you some dance lessons." And that's why she's a prima ballerina. On the other hand, last summer I was in a ministry doing a workshop with a mission team, and one of the volunteers that worked there regularly called me over and said, "You weren't here last week to train them. Can you tell these people not to tell the kids they stink and they need a bath? Because that was that child's first time in this church, and he'll never come back again." Now, I am sure the person who said that had the best of intentions. I'm going to give them the benefit of the doubt. But they now put that child in the path where somebody's going to really have to work hard to get that kid back in a church building again. And so the empathy, I cannot cannot emphasize how much you need to do that empathy training, and we can help you. I'll give you the script. I'll tell you what to do. Just do it. Other training you volunteers are going to need: classroom management, activity planning, execution, storytelling, face sharing, volunteer spiritual growth goals, reading lists. We've got a great resource of some of our favorite reading things. Info on your program, if you have a program. Empathy books, books on culture, special needs of your kids, even questions for directed thinking or Bible study. You don't necessarily have to be the one who provides the training, but you need to make sure all of your volunteers are getting this if you really want to have a highly impactful ministry to kids. The other thing that we found that makes a huge difference, and I didn't realize this until I started doing some research, is making sure your volunteers cover more Bible stories. We'll talk more about this in a little bit in curriculum, but someone did some research. The average curriculum that you can purchase only covers 30 Bible stories, and they just repeat those over and over again. When we started doing this on parenting, on Teach One, Reach One, and I actually need to go back and add a couple, there's actually over 200 Bible stories that are appropriate for children. So if you're using prepared curriculum and that's all the Bible your kids are getting, they're only getting about 10 to 20% of what's in the Bible. They're also probably not being exposed to the prophets, the epistles, the wisdom literature or poetry, and they're probably tuning out in part because they're bored. Your volunteers will also find they're having classroom management issues because of this boredom. So sometimes just changing your curriculum or enhancing your curriculum can help your volunteers with that sort of thing. We also don't have the time to address this, but if you work with mission teams, come to me. We have a lot of small practical things you can do that will help your mission teams be more effective. In fact, we'll have an ebook coming out later this summer free online to give to mission teams to help them be very, very effective with children, very, very organized and more impactful if you work with mission teams. Another area important to volunteers in your ministry is to provide opportunities for reflection. You need to have regular opportunities where they tell you what's going well, what's not going well, what concerns they have. We are afraid of feedback. And the problem with that is it can become a cancer because the negative things don't go away. If you address them, if you correct them, that's going to help your ministry. If you pretend like they're not there because you don't want to get your feelings hurt or whatever, it could become a cancer that will destroy your ministry. So get that feedback from them. Floaters and substitutes. We'll talk about floaters later. If you have a children's ministry and you're in charge, get a substitute team. It will save your life. Oh, it's the best thing I ever did years and years ago. You have several people, however many you want, they are assigned a week. So they know that Sunday morning, if anybody's out, they are the substitute on call. Schools have done this for years. I don't know why we haven't picked up on it sooner. It will save you so much trouble, so much hassle trying to call around or grab somebody out of the thing. They know they come, they're prepared to substitute if they're needed. They may not be, but at least they're prepared and you don't have a lot of that hassle to deal with. We can help you. We have a teacher tip blog that we put out a post once a week. We have lesson plans, activity ideas, trainer intensives where we can train your people to train your volunteers that come through. We can come conduct workshops at your site. We have videos, recipes, scripts, and it is a developed ministry. God took this ministry and kind of leapfrogged it. So keep checking back if something you need is on the website. It will be in a week or a month or 6 months from now, so keep checking back. Curriculum. If you think back to our original three lessons, which one of the students is going to remember years from now? They're going to eat those locusts, right? And which one are they actually going to have the most memory of the principles and what? It's when we're talking about how we share our faith and not just the facts of the story of John the Baptist. We have a lot of lesson plans. Like I mentioned, we have over 200, and they include a link to the scripture. If you go online, they're all free. It will link you directly to scripture. We have learning objectives, so your teachers know these are the main points we want our kids to get out of this lesson today. We also have interesting facts, which I have not seen a lot of places. These could be historical, cultural, archaeological finds, things that kids like really think are cool. This is going to make the Bible cool to them. If you don't use our site for anything else, you've got your own literature and you love it, that's great. Go pull up those interesting facts because kids just love those. It makes the Bible real. It makes it more understandable, so use those. Then underneath all those, we have activity ideas. We have multiple of those tied to the Bible. First of all, we have our Bible activities. These are primarily a lot of cultural things. Our children's culture is so different from Bible time culture. The things that we think they understand have zero meaning to them or very little. If you say Jesus is our shepherd, they maybe can think of sheep, But they don't understand all the depth and the richness of a shepherd and how well they know their sheep and all that sort of thing, because that's not their culture. They don't know it. We just recently, and we've done this a lot in different places, but we recently did a wedding one where the kids literally participated, dressed in everything, in a biblical engagement, a wedding banquet. And so in the context of the wedding parables and Jesus turning the wine into water, so they understand now, what is this thing with oil and lamps? And I don't even get that. What does oil have to do with a lamp? I go flick on a switch. You know, we don't think about that sort of thing. But if you don't know what an oil is and why it needs lamp and why it matters that you ran out of lamp oil and don't have enough, that parable has pretty much zero meaning to you. So it let your kids experience. So our activities are helping your kids experience or understand a lot of that cultural stuff. Our application activities actually are more about the principles behind the lessons, helping them understand, why did God put that story in the Bible? What am I supposed to do with that? And then helping them practice that or understand it better depending on their age and what the concept is. Also, we have service projects tied to every Bible lesson. Now, I'm not suggesting you do this every week, but if you, and I know we're a lot better at this than we used to, if you do not have your children serving other people, start now. We work with an orphanage in Mexico, and the first couple of seasons we had mission teams. Suddenly, our children's home children were becoming entitled. We thought, well, that's kind of strange. But we realized what it was is they were being constantly served by other people. And then they began to think that that was their purpose in life, is to be served and entertained by other people. And so what we did, we switched it up, and we had them, they actually serve the mission team a meal before they start the week. They cook it and serve it and clean up from it, and we have them serve it in the community. And almost all those entitlement issues just dropped off immediately. So really, service is crucial. Now, if you're doing secular tutoring or think about doing secular tutoring with your children, one of the things I've seen over and over, if programs have a really difficult time in figuring out how to tie the Bible and the secular subjects together. So generally what will happen in those programs is they have a Bible story, and then they break up and they're just doing math or they're just doing English or whatever they're tutoring, and there's no tie back. We've created activities that have a strong tie back to the Bible story so that it makes sense for that center teacher to review the Bible story they just had in context of the secular subject. For example, if we're doing creation and we're doing math, well, there's a lot of time in creation. Well, remember we talked about the days and da-da-da-da-da, and then we'll do a telling time activity where there are human clocks and that kind of thing. But it allows them, so it's a stronger tie and allows people to really hit that Bible part of it harder than they normally are able to. So we have English as a second language activities. We have language arts, both early and advanced elementary, early and advanced math, science, health, and hygiene. And if you're working in second and third world countries or highly impoverished areas, we also have sustenance and survival skills tied to the Bible activities. All of our activities are hands-on, experiential, meaningful, which means they're actually getting some meaning out of them. They're just not fun like our popping the balloons where there's not much meaning there, and they're memorable. Once again, we have guided learning. Even in our activities, we have a guiding question. So you ask ahead of time, like we did with the t-shirts. What, you know, how do we share, tell other people about Jesus? Then they do the activity, and the whole time they're thinking, this is what I'm supposed to be learning. And then you can check at the end, because as we all know, if you work with kids, sometimes what they get out of something is not what you meant for them to get out of it. And so this is just a way of double checking that what they go home telling mom and dad they learned is really what you wanted them to learn. Especially if you work with younger kids, you really know what I mean on that one. This is what I want you, if you walk out of this room and I ever walk into your children's ministry or your classroom if you're a teacher and I see a coloring sheet, I will cry. I will literally sit down and cry. Please, I beg you, ban coloring sheets. Ban those worksheets for the older kids. I was just, and they don't have an option in Spanish, unfortunately, but I was just in another country, and every single week the younger children had some form of a coloring sheet. And every single week, the older children had some form of a worksheet. And they were having all kinds of behavior problems. And I walked in and was like, it's the literature. Those kids are bored out of their minds. And sure enough, they switched up some things and switched activities. And they were like brand new children. And I'm like, I'm looking at your kids. Your kids are good kids. It's not the kids. It's what you're doing with them. So ban those color sheets. We have very, very little time with these kids. Make the most of it. You know, you can convince yourself whatever you want to convince yourself with coloring sheets, but the reality is all they're learning from a coloring sheet is what colors look pretty. That is it. They're getting no added value from that. And if you're teaching really little kids, this poor woman, I just felt so badly for her. She had 2 and 3 year olds, and it was a coloring sheet, and then it had to be cut, and then it had to be pasted, and then it had to be glued. And they literally, the 2 and 3 year olds were watching her do 15 of their things by herself because they were incapable of doing all those things because developmentally they're just not there. So get rid of those. We also have teen lessons. This was not our intent to go into the teen field, but we were begged, and so we kind of did. We have a few lessons up there that I've used before and that our daughter has used here on campus with some teen groups. But what had happened earlier this year, we went to an urban conference, and there's nothing for teens. So we're actually developing curriculum for them in mind, which some of you guys may be interested in or should start going up this summer. They have two-hour blocks. So the first hour in typical teen curriculum right now is to let them bond by chit-chatting and having fun for 20, 30, 40 minutes and then have like a 15-minute Devo. I can't tell you how anti that I am, because brain research shows you those kids are not bonding by chilling. They bond by sharing their hearts with each other. That's the real bonding you want. And they're not doing that just chit-chatting, most likely, about sports scores or playing some silly game. So what we've done is we have an optional activity at the beginning that's fun, but it's tied to the lesson. It has them sharing their hearts and minds. Then we have the lesson. Then that second hour actually is going to be designed where they are going to have some practical experience and practice in life skills, like conflict management. Why are we telling 4 and 5 year old kids to work out conflict for themselves? That's why we have grown-ups hitting each other and cursing each other and screaming. No, you have to teach someone how to handle conflict in godly ways. You know, budgeting, all those sorts of things. So that's what's going to be in the teen curriculum, so start looking for that later this summer. I know when you're seeing all this and you're thinking, edible locust t-shirts, if you don't have a big budget, you're thinking this is going to cost a fortune, even though this is all free. But what we did when we designed this, it was with urban ministries and mission fields in mind. So we try to be very cognizant of that. We have a lot of found objects, recycled stuff, stuff that you may already have around, stuff that other people have that they would give you. Occasionally you will see in there, if you have money, here's a fun extra thing you can do in there. So don't worry about the money. Classroom management. Okay, this picture of kids, this is actually our church wall, and we have taped a mural to it that they're painting for Haiti, and they're using real acrylic paints. And you may, depending on what your kids are like in your church, may be thinking, never in my life will that ever happen. But I can promise you, if you have trained your volunteers and you have proper classroom management things in place, you can do this anywhere. Structure is mandatory for learning. These sweet Christians who are allowing your students to run wild are not ensuring they're going to come back. They're ensuring no one's learning anything. I just had this situation, same mission trip, a volunteer. This is not my church, so they had not been trained by me, but I went with them to test some stuff for some friends. And I was correcting a student who was out of control, very firm but loving, very loving. And one of the other volunteers pulled me aside, like, why are you being mean? And I had to stop and think for a minute. I'm like, what are you even talking about? And then I thought, I was correcting that child. And I said, here's what you got to understand. I'm being mean if I don't correct that child. It is not being loving to let that child run wild and, in this case, distract 150 children that were already in a rather distracting environment from learning. It's being loving to correct him in appropriate ways so that he and the other children can learn. And you'll have to work with a lot of your volunteers on that, because they do have that mindset. This area is also going to be the most likely to put your students and even the existence of your program or church at risk. I have heard so many horror stories. Do not fool yourself. I have heard of children being raped. I have heard of children being grabbed by non-custodial parents. It happens in churches all the time. Do not live in naivety anymore. You must do background checks on any adult that has any contact with your children. I understand they only pull up felony convictions, which in my experience has usually been DUIs. But what it does is, if a predator comes in, they target churches because they're nice people who don't ask questions. And they target churches especially that work in areas that have children that they perceive do not have a lot of parental support. But if they come in and they know you're doing background checks and asking questions, they're going to move on because there are other churches that are going to be easier to deal with. So just having that in place is going to deter a lot of people, whether they're convicted or not. And it's very cheap. It used to be very expensive. Now I think you can get them for $5, $10 a pop. So and a lot of people will even pay for their own if you have some budget issues. You also need to have, and I have not seen a lot of people that have this, have specific written guidelines for classroom management. There are a lot of people that do a lot of things in the name of classroom management that are not appropriate. They may be appropriate in your personal home, but it's not appropriate with other people's children. And you're not aware that they're doing this. I've seen some really interesting things and heard some really interesting things. I did one last summer, and I said, well, how did that classroom management piece work? And like, oh, it's great. None of the kids got hit this summer. And I went, what? So we have a sample here for you to take. Run it by your lawyers. We have not lawyerified this. And you may have specific things you want to address, but it'll give you some ideas of things that we have seen and heard that happen regularly. Having that in place, making sure all your volunteers have to read it and even sign it, means you can't have volunteer conflict. No, we said that's not an appropriate way to touch, or you have to have your door open or whatever. Or if, God forbid, something horrible does happen and the authorities come in, you've got some backup saying, we tell our volunteers that's not appropriate. You know, we have structure in place, and so you protect your program and your church. Classroom management behaving, once again, check your curriculum activities. A lot of your behavior problems may be because the kids are bored. Empathy training, the volunteers, it's going to keep down the tacky things that are said to kids that scar them and get parents upset. Behavior management is going to keep a lot of the interesting things that are done in the name of classroom management from happening. Floaters. Okay, here's another safety thing that most people do not do. You need windows in your doors. If you don't have windows, you need an open door policy. I don't care if it's noisy. And you need to try and keep two adults with children at all times. If you have to have one, sometimes that has to happen, but keep that door open. And you need a floater. And that floater needs to peek in every room every couple of minutes because, one, it keeps the teacher from having to disrupt their lesson. If there's a behavior management problem, if a child has to go to the bathroom and you want them to get there safely, if somebody's sick or you run out of material or whatever, they can keep teaching because they can just say, hey, can you, or point or whatever, and continue and not have to take 5 or 10 minutes out of your valuable class time handling that. Also, your floater should be really well trained, so if they do walk in on something tacky happening, they can nip it in the bud, and that's going to save you a lot of hassles down the road. Or at least, especially that you know that it happens, that says 6 months later when the parent comes in screaming at you. Remember, your kids can be in a fun, somewhat noisy environment and learn more than ever if it's managed properly. On the other hand, one mistake is going to shut you down. Family involvement. I know we're running out of time, but I just want to point this out. One of the biggest mistakes we make as a middle-class, well-educated body is that Christian parenting skills are common knowledge. They have not been common knowledge for a very, very long time. So they must be taught. Do not assume your parents know how to be a Christian parent. Your program is going to be more effective if you can get the parents to extend the learning at home. We have online one of our most popular resources. We have a free baptism study that we've written that's online. It has a leader guide for the parent. It was designed for parents and Sunday school teachers to study baptism with older children and teens. We've gotten so much positive feedback. Parents love this because they're very nervous about doing this with their children. But it just kind of gently walks them through it, tells them how to deal with a child that is ready for baptism and how to deal with one that they need to slow down for some reason. Maybe they're not mature enough, but they just want to go play in the water or whatever. So it's designed for that. We have printable parenting resources. My daughter will give you one of the examples, the bookmarks. Yeah. They are online. They're in English and Spanish. We have a lot more that should be going up in the next couple of months. But these are things you can print off and share with your parents. They are all tip sheets, so it's a quick, easy thing on different subjects. They can put it on the refrigerator. This one that's going around is a Bible bookmark. They stick in the Bible, how to read the Bible and help your child understand it. And what books, because you don't ever start a child reading the Bible straight through. So it talks about the best books. We have them on conflict management. Just anything you can think of. But they're all very tips and usually have no more than 10 tips. Walks them through how to teach their kids how to do things from a Christian perspective. Parent letters. If you're not doing this, in fact, I was just talking with the lady back here in the back that we work with some of their stuff with them on. Parent letters can really help you a lot. It sounds boring and tedious. You can email them, but it makes a big difference. Let your parents know what was done in class, What was the story? What did the kids do? What were they supposed to get from it? How can they extend the learning at home? Give them a fun idea of something little they can do with their kids that week and talk about so that they can continue to extend that learning, because you really can't do it all in an hour a week. Parenting workshops, we have those we can help you with. Parenting mentors, we are getting this request over and over and over, and we're not really equipped to do this yet for you. But parents, young moms, want moms who have successfully raised Christian children to adulthood who are still faithful in the church. They want to be able to talk to those women, especially if they've had a special needs child or a child with special health program. Make those relationships happen, because these young moms don't know how to do it on their own, and they're dying for it. They want it so badly. Parenting Like Hannah is our parenting arm. Actually, that started before Teach One, Reach One. Like I said, we have blog posts 3 times a week, just parenting tips, fun things to do with your kid to bring God into your home, resources we liked, all sorts of things like that. So have your parents go on that. It's free, and it makes you look good that you've got something to give them for free. Parent-student activities. We just started experimenting with this in a public school in Atlanta this year, and it's been phenomenal, so I want to encourage churches to roll it out. Once a month, we do a thing where the parents and kids come together. We do a little mini parenting class where the kids get to also hear what's going to start happening at home. But then the parents and the kids work together on a project or a fun activity or something that will help them do that or learn how to do that. And it's really fun. Those have really gone over well. So consider doing that. I'm hoping this group is not a big issue, but I want to emphasize this so badly. Get your children into the NIRV Bible, okay? I don't know why we don't talk about this. In teaching reading, if you put a child in a text or a book that is several levels above their comfortable reading level, it's called a frustration text, which means they will hate that book. And what we have historically done is giving 3rd, 4th, and 5th grade children Bibles that are written on the 7th, 8th, 9th, 10th, 11th, 12th, 13th grade reading levels. Personally, King James, hello. That's how old I am. Thankfully, NIV came out when I wasn't too old. But anyway, and that's still 7th or 8th grade, I believe. And then we wonder why kids don't like to read the Bible. Because they didn't understand it the first time they were given one, and it was hard, and they hated it, and it didn't make any sense. If you want your children to grow up loving to read the Bible, get them the NIRV. It is, so far, the only translation I have found, and it's on a 3rd grade reading level. There are some paraphrases out there that are like 5th, but I personally am not a paraphrase fan. NIRV is not perfect, but it's close enough, and it's going to get your kids loving the Bible, and you can transition them to other versions as they get older and can read better. Also, if you work with parents that are not well-educated, they need one in the home, too. That's why a lot of adults aren't reading the Bible either, because they have Bibles that are above their reading level. Don't assume because you're in a middle-class church. We're in an upper-middle-class church, and I had a woman whisper to me to the side that she reads on third-grade reading level. So don't just assume because someone's middle-class that they can read at a college level. You may be needing to get a lot of your families into those NIRVs if you want them reading their Bibles. She just gave you a handout that kind of breaks down the resources in the different areas that we have.
If you didn't get a handout, you can sign up for one, and we can email it.
Yeah, and we've got a little fish up here that I want you to take, because I want you to have something to look at that you have, like on a bracelet or necklace or your desk or your billboard or whatever, that reminds you that you had this seminar and that you want to and need to and should be making changes. I'll start passing this around, but I do have time here to meet with you privately if you have questions or problems or want some private consultations on anything we've talked about. Over here, you're going to find some resources we didn't even get into. I'm big on Bloom's taxonomy. A lot of these things we learn in education school, in spite of what you may feel about public schools, there are some very valuable things that we are taught. And one of them is Bloom's taxonomy, and it talks about how you need to move kids through different varying levels of understanding for them to really get the Bible. And we skip levels and miss levels, and so we've broken that down for kids' classes here and questions that will help move them levels. Just other practical stuff like that for your teaching. And then over here, if you work with volunteers and mission teams, there's a lot of stuff over here too. So help yourself. If you see something ran out and your friend has it, write it on your contact sheet and we'll make sure you get it. Thank you.
Thank you.